Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this first day of fall, 22nd of September. On July 4 of this year, Andrew Carroll started on a 50-state journey to locate forgotten history sites and to talk with Americans all over this country about their favorite spots. Andrew is a historian, and his latest project is Here Is Where, in search of America's great forgotten history. They find and spotlight little-known and unmarked historic sites throughout the United States. He's also the founder of the Legacy Project, which you're probably familiar with, in 1998. Since then, it's been collecting and archiving wartime correspondence as a way of honoring and remembering the nation's veterans, active duty troops, and their families. And our guest believes that their sacrifices, humanity, and experiences are best recorded in their own words, the personal letters and emails that they have written in times of war. So we're going to be talking about, well, we can talk about that, but our focus this hour is on Here Is Where. Andrew has written, I don't know where he is now, but he's written about a number of different states already, some fascinating stories from Atlanta and from Washington, D.C. and Boston and New York. And he's with us for this hour to talk about all of this. And, you know, I thought it might be kind of fun for you to give us suggestions during the hour of places that you think you ought to look at. Obviously, in Wisconsin would be great, but beyond Wisconsin as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning. Great to talk to you. I'm not really sure where I am either at this point. I think I'm in Connecticut.
You think you're in Connecticut. You've really been on the road. You've been to so many places already, and it's early in the journey.
I don't know the number of states I've been in, and I've been on the road almost nonstop since July. I go home just every couple weeks for a day or two to make sure the place hasn't burned down and to pay bills and things like that, and then it's right back out on the road. And it has, I mean, the journey could not be going any better. Everywhere I visit, people are going out of their way to be helpful, to share stories. It really is an incredible experience. And I, being Irish by nature, I just assumed everything was going to sort of go wrong from the start. but with the exception of a couple speeding tickets and some close calls here and there, it really has been flawless and just quite the trip of a lifetime.
Oh, I imagine. I would think, Andrew, that you're going to have so many sites you can't keep up with them.
Well, that's the great thing about this project, and the one thing I always try and convey to people, it's not about this trip. This is just to launch the project. I mean, I plan to keep going back to these states and keep getting ideas from people. It's funny because I was just in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'd been there a couple of years ago. Whenever I travel on business, I always like to look up little forgotten history sites. So on this second trip, I was going to places I'd walk past the first time, not knowing that there was something amazing that had happened there. So this is going to be the way it is. It's just people will keep telling me about new sites that I missed, and I'll go back, and I'm photographing them, blogging with National Geographic, and it's part of this larger project because what I really want to do is to get many, not all, but most of these sites marked so that we have plaques and signs up in the relevant places.
Well, that would make sense.
Absolutely. And what's great is that, you know, I want to work with the local historical societies,
right,
raise funds for them. It's all about preserving our history, which is all around us. And it just, I think, you know, people get very passionate about this because it's about their hometown, about their community. And I love seeing that sense of pride in where we live and hopefully to inspire it as well, maybe in a younger generation.
And you see that the vast majority of these places are right in front of us, just waiting to be discovered.
Absolutely, especially in the major cities. Now, I don't want to be an urban elitist, so I'm going to a lot of, you know, remote areas and places out in country and places in Alaska and the Midwest and so forth that, you know, aren't, you know, you got to do a little bit of driving or hiking to get to. But it's more even the stories are somewhat remote in our national landscape. And I want to bring them to the forefront because they're stories that deserve to be told. You know, for example, I was in Montana in a very out-of-the-way spot near the Marias River, and there was a massacre that took place there back in 1870. And it's one of the worst massacres in American history, and it should be remembered. And even though it's remote, it doesn't mean that it has to be forgotten in our national story and national narrative. And there's some very positive stories about inventors and scientists and doctors who've created these extraordinary things, and where they had their burst of inspiration or where they conducted you know, an experiment that has changed all of our lives, that place might have been unmarked. So it's really just to show the diversity of these spots and these stories, and most of all to galvanize other people to think about, not just for me to say, you know, here's where this happened, but to get people thinking like, wait a minute, I remember my grandmother told me a story about something that happened in our neighborhood,
right.
And I'll send it into the Here's Where project.
Yeah, great. And to get back to that massacre, that was one of those stories where you were, and this all happens, this happens to all of us, I think. You're driving along and you see this sign on the side of the road says, historical marker, and you think, oh my gosh, I got to stop. But this one, I think you did, but you had to go way out of your way to find out what the historical marker was.
Oh, that's right, yeah, and that's actually a different spot. That was that was in Nevada, but no, you're absolutely right. And in fact, I thought that was going to be a massacre of Native Americans. It turns out it was a massacre by Native Americans on that site. That was the point of that story was really how one of the things I wanted to find. I'm sure many of your listeners have had this experience where you're flying down the highway and there's a marker on the side of the road, and I don't see how they expect us to read it because there's no shoulder. You can't stop, and there's a lot of text. So I wanted to photograph one of those. But as I was driving through Nevada, I came across a sign that just said historic marker, you know, up the road. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll go check it out. And I just kept driving and driving and driving through this really gravelly off the beaten path road, wondering like, you know, I wish they'd said it's half a mile or 10 miles or whatever. But I finally got to it. And once you get there, it just says Gunnison Massacre, ask at local museum about what happened. So I'm like, well, okay. So then I asked the museum, and they told me what happened. But it was just one of those experiences that I thought was sort of funny from a sign perspective.
Ask at the local museum
right.
What happened. I love that story. Actually, the story that got me trying to track you right away was the Abraham Lincoln story, which is, I never had heard that before.
Well, and also that's the story that really inspired this whole project. I heard it about 15 years ago. And so the story is, we don't know the exact month or year, but it was during the Civil War. It was about 1863, 1864. A young man was standing on a railroad platform at what's called the Exchange Place, and it's not the exact site there today, but it's pretty close. And what happened was, just as a train was leaving, he fell between the platform and the train. And this was back in the day before they didn't have all the safety measures we have now, but he was literally about to be crushed by this train disembarking from the station. Another man, at just the last split second, rushed over, grabbed him by the back of the lapels, and yanked him to safety. The man who fell was Robert Todd Lincoln, the son of the president, and Lincoln, of course, was president at the time. The man who grabbed him was Edwin Booth.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, when I heard this story, I thought, this must be apocryphal. It has a very urban legend kind of feel.
Yeah, yeah.
But sure enough, I did research on it. There's a letter that Robert Todd himself wrote to a magazine at the time, which had asked him to clarify, because there was a lot of speculation of what happened. And he said, it's absolutely true. He said, when he pulled me up, I turned around, and I immediately recognized him because he was a famous actor of the day, more famous than his brother John Wilkes. And I said, Mr. Booth. And he said, Mr. Lincoln. And that was the – and they I don't think they ever saw each other again, because this letter was written some years later. He never alluded to a future meeting. But it's just extraordinary that about a year before the assassination, you have the brother of the assassin saving the son of the president. And what got me thinking was, if that platform, or even if that commuter rail is still there, all these people who get on there in the morning and then get off there in the afternoon probably have no idea, because it's not marked, of this extraordinary intersection of history that happened 140-some years ago. And so it just got me thinking, like, well, what else is around us? And so I started collecting these files, and what began as this fat little manila folder is now 24 filing cabinets full of stories.
Oh, my gosh. Is it really, Andrew?
So,
oh. Yeah, that place needs to be marked. That story about the Booth and Lincoln is quite remarkable.
Absolutely.
You'll just never ride the train and think about it in the same way.
Exactly. And that's what these stories have the power to do, is transform the places we live near or, you know, live in,
right,
so that we see them almost as if for the first time. And if nothing else, it creates a kind of sense of wonder about, well, what else is around us?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that Winston Churchill was hit by a car in New York and very seriously hurt.
That's right. Well, he's half American. I mean, I think his mother was American, and so he would come to the States frequently, and he was on a speaking tour. This is back well before he was prime minister. I think it was, 31 or so. I don't have the date in front of me. And he was going to meet a friend of his, Bernard Baruch, who was a prominent financier at the time and a friend of his. And he did what many of us do, who, if you travel to England, and for the British who travel here, while crossing the street, we look the wrong way because the traffic's going in a different direction than what we're used to. And he got hit hard by a car that was coming up the correct way. He looked the wrong way. And it sent him flying. And this was not just a little fender bender thing. I mean, he was, I think the car was going at 35 miles an hour. The man rushed out. He was so apologetic. And to Churchill's credit, the first thing he said as a group of people came over to see if he was okay was, it's my fault. I'm in the wrong here. They rushed him to, I think it was Lenox Hill Hospital, and he spent the next couple of weeks recuperating. And he wrote a very interesting account of what happened, so we have his perspective of the whole incident. And but he really came close to dying. And it's interesting, if you think about going through World War II without Churchill's leadership and so forth, how different things might have been. And it's just one of those what ifs. But not far across town at what used to be a department store, I think it's a sort of electronics store that's going out of business right now, is where Martin Luther King was almost killed. This is 10 years
when
before.
When he was stabbed?
Yeah, he was stabbed. He was there for a book event, and he was stabbed pretty close to the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that was well before the I Have a Dream speech and all the other great things that he did. And it is these sort of pivot points in history where if literally just things had gone slightly different, how much history would have been transformed.
Yeah. Oh, you must live your day every day going, whew.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
But the joy is when people tell me stories. That's what I really love, is when it gets them thinking and then they suggest their own favorite spots. And I am trying to focus on places that don't just have regional significance. I'm not interested in staying in the oldest hotel in Hartford, Connecticut.
Right.
I'm interested in an incident that might have happened here that affects all of us. And so that's the thing that we would, just to kind of keep things a little more simple.
Yeah.
That's going to be, because I am doing a book of these with Crown. It'll be out next year. And it's so I'm going to be focusing on the best story from each of the 50 states.
Oh, that'll be fascinating. The story that's, it's only a couple blocks from where we are, it may make the book if you're in Milwaukee, was when the assassination attempt on Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt, one of my favorite stories.
Oh, and so it's going to be in the book?
Well, it's marked, actually. Inside the hotel, they do have a plaque and a real nice display about what happened. It happened actually outside a little bit up. I was talking to some of the people out there because I did visit Milwaukee several times, actually. And so that story I'll probably allude to, but it won't be a featured story only because they've done what I hope people will do, and they've already marked it. So now there's nothing outside about it, so if you're walking by the hotel, you wouldn't know. But inside the hotel, there is definitely a nice display. And for listeners who may not be familiar with the story, T.R., this is after he was president, and he'd been out of office. He was running again, and he was, I think, stepping into a car to go give a speech, and a man walked up to him and shot him in the chest. And what saved him was the folded speech, which was very dense, and his eyeglass cases. And there's actually a photo of this where you can see the bullet-pierced paper and the dented eyeglass case, but it still went into his chest. And his driver and his staff, like, we have to rush you to the hospital. He said, absolutely not. I'm giving the speech.
Oh, my gosh.
So and this is all documented. It's not, again, not urban legend.
Right.
In the bloody shirt, he gives this talk, and he starts off by saying that, friends, I need to tell you, I've just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose.
Whoa.
Very dramatic.
I had no idea there was a display. How can I talk about something right around the corner from where I am? I knew it had happened, but I've never seen that display inside
the
hotel.
And to be fair, it is a place that I think deserves a marker on the outside, so anyone driving by would know it happened.
Hmm. And the other thing, I was thinking about a couple of the car things, which makes you think to follow the advice Mom gave you, be careful when you're crossing the street. Margaret Mitchell in Atlanta.
Yep. And that's a story. I think a lot of people in Atlanta are familiar with that, because what I love is when I come to a place and I'll have like a local tour guide take me around and say, look, I think your project sounds really neat, but for those of us who live here, we're going to know all the stories. Well, even in those cases, we find some surprises, like, wow, there really are some stories out there that even we didn't know about. The Margaret Mitchell thing, I think, is pretty well known in Atlanta, but she was also crossing the street. In this case, she ended up dying, and it's quite tragic. And this is, of course, Margaret Mitchell of Gone with the Wind fame. And she wasn't killed instantly, and it was right in front of a certain house where there is a historical marker, but not about that incident. And so I had this great guy, John Lewis, in Atlanta, who was taking me around and showing me sites. Usually I'm the one who's, taking people and saying, hey, here's where I want to go. And, boy, the history that he was telling me just all throughout that city was really incredible.
Hmm. I would imagine you must run into people in all the places you go, even at a local cafe, who are telling you about places that you didn't know about, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm ignorant when it comes to this stuff. I'm just learning. I feel like I'm new to this, even though I've been saving these stories for so long. Because some of them don't pan out. Some of them do turn out to be legends, or they can't be confirmed. And I want to be pretty ruthless about making sure that we can document. For example, I was just in Newark, New Jersey, following a story about a woman named Clara Moss, who was a great nurse, who actually ended up infecting herself with yellow fever through a mosquito bite to experiment, and she did this with other doctors, if yellow fever was spread through water or through mosquitoes, or, you know, for a long time people thought it was just contamination through the water system, and then they realized, no, it was the mosquitoes, but she died because of this. There's a postage stamp that bears her name. I think it's a 13-cent stamp.
Oh,
but we, I was working with the local historical society. We just couldn't pinpoint the exact street where she was born, because I thought it'd be great to put up a marker for this really heroic woman who
yes.
literally gave her life. And we just couldn't. We just still can't find it. So that's so. Unfortunately, I can't make her a featured story of the book because, you know, again, I want to be able to document and say this is exactly where it happened. But definitely someone I want to talk about.
And people go to, how do they follow your blog? I've got a lot of the pictures, but I don't know.
The easiest thing to do is go to Here Is Where, which is the name of the whole project, hereiswhere.org, O-R-G. And if through there, you can find the link to the National Geographic blog. And also, now, I'm supposed to be Twittering as I go because that's the law, but I just, I have to be honest, I'm really having trouble keeping up with that because between the blog and the book and everything else,
right.
I've got to save some of the stories for the book, and if they're all out there, it takes the fun out of it. But what I was thinking about doing was just travel tips, so because I'm learning all sorts of things about that when you hit all 50 states on just little travel secrets along the way.
Andrew Carroll, our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. His latest project as a historian is Here Is Where, In Search of America's Great Forgotten History, which will take him to all 50 states. And stories, I mean, he's got, as he said, file cabinets filled with stories, but we're featuring a few of them and talking about what he's seeing along the road. And you can give him stories as well. That's what we're looking for this hour. To you in a moment, our email address, talk@WPR.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Andrew. Let's start with Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. The story I'm going to tell, this has nothing to do with national. This is more local history. They built a railroad out of Waseca. They started in the spring of 1892, and they finished in 1897. It ran about 50 miles in this hill country. They had to go through swamps and everything to get pretty much to get it completed. And it was one of the little stump dodgers, if you want to put it that way. But there was one story about a school teacher that lived in Lafarge, and he'd catch the morning train south of Iola for the Kickapoo Center School where he taught. He'd stay down there during the week, and Friday afternoons he'd flag the train and catch a ride home back to Lafarge. But they had about 8 or 9 stops. They finished the line in 97. There was a railroad tunnel. There was a railroad tunnel just north of us, about 3 miles. When they built the, they put the new section of road in the year 1970, they took the tunnel out. And a friend of mine who's now dead and gone, he said even he was a child growing up, he could remember the train wouldn't be able to make the tunnel in the wintertime. He'd have to drop sand and back up a half a mile or so and take another run at it to get through it. And there's a friend, there's a guy, gentleman living in Lafarge. He's in his 90s now. I believe he's in a nursing home. They had a Y up there where they turned the engine around, and he very nicely explained to me one day at the meal site how they put a train engine to bed.
How'd they do that?
Pardon?
How did they do that? How did they put it to bed?
They had to disconnect all the valves, drain the water out and everything, I guess.
Oh, wow. Well, and I should clarify, even though for my purposes I'm looking for national stories, I think it's so important that we do tell the stories of our own communities and we pass them down. You know, even if it gets us talking to our neighbors, I have a gentleman who lives across the hall from me in my apartment building who, you know, I know, but until this project, it didn't really inspire me to sit down and talk with him. He's a World War II veteran, and the stories he has of his experiences – in the Pacific and flying with the U.S. Army Air Corps are absolutely fascinating, and I never really pursued those until it got me thinking, like, well, how about even the people I live around? What have they been through? What have they done? And even our own home, I found out some interesting that they discovered some World War One munitions buried around our neighborhood.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it turned out to be this huge thing in Washington, D.C., and it was literally right around our house and other people's homes in the area. So there is something about learning about your own community. So I didn't mean to be dismissive about national versus regional stories, that sort of thing, because I think all these stories are important. And, Eugene, you also mentioned just that this was a teacher, which just got me off on a thought that the most enthusiastic responses we've been having are from teachers themselves. And a woman who I met through the War Letters Project in Seattle is a teacher. Last spring, when I was first talking about this project, she got her students to go out and find their own forgotten history sites around Seattle and Washington State.
Great idea.
Yeah, and she said, you know, this is the first time that my students came back and felt so passionate because they weren't just passively, you know, listening to these stories. They were the ones going out finding them, and it completely shifted how they thought about history and about their connection to their own community. And so, you know, one of the things we really hope to do is set up a real curricula and ideas for teachers. And now, my friend just did this on her own, so she, you know, it's possible without any kind of advice from us. But there really, it is a great way of getting young people active in their communities and talking to their own parents about their family history and learning those local stories that I think all of us need to know.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Eugene, for your call. And it was, talking about your neighbor, it was wartime correspondence that got you going in history, wasn't it?
Well, I grew up hating history, which is why I can really empathize with students out there who, like, I don't like it. It's just all this memorization of facts and dates and names and so forth. And that's, of course, not history. History is about great stories. It's about learning our heritage, where we're from, and all these other, you know, aspects I can get into. But what happened was right before Christmas of 89, so, you know, boy, about 20 years ago, our house in Washington, D.C. burned down. Everything was destroyed. The worst thing for me was losing all of our family letters, just because they were truly irreplaceable. And one thing led to another, and I began preserving wartime correspondence, really because I thought the letters should be saved. And it was in reading the content of those letters that I was hearing little-known stories from wartime. And that really lit the fire for my own interest. And now it's turned into a general love and passion for history, not just military history, although I'm very close to that. And so the book in the Here's Where project is not about military sites, even though we talked about Churchill and Lincoln and so forth. But so much of our history has been shaped by war. But it's really all different aspects. As I was talking about technological innovations and medical innovations and explorers and all these different themes that are out there to pursue.
Let's go next to Daniel from Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. East of Rice Lake, Wisconsin, is an ancient pipestone quarry site sacred to the Indians. Due to long-term Native American habitation, a clearing still exists. The mineral rights to the pipestone belongs to Cornell University. It was a high holy site sacred to the Native Americans for thousands of years. It is a worthy site to see and catalog.
Ooh, and where is it, Daniel?
East of Rice Lake on off of County C.
County C.
I'm writing this down. I really appreciate that. Yeah, because I absolutely want to make sure that Native American stories are part of this book and part of this project. So much of their history has been forgotten or overlooked, and along with African American and Latino history as well. And so it's really a priority for us to find sites that relate to these events and these aspects of our communal history. It really, you know, this project's not about, well, let's focus on African-American history or on women's history. It's all American history. It's all about, you know, the land and who we are, where we've come from, all of us from different places. And, you know, the convergence of these ideas and these events that I think have impacted all of us.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for your call. Bruce from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Great topic. Thanks for your comments, Andrew. I happen to know where the first superhighway was built in the United States.
Now, I'm glad you brought this up, because that is a story that fascinates me, and there's some debate about this. So I'm very curious to hear your recommendation on this.
Well, I did research on this 30 years ago, and it was a highway to be built between, it was an extension of a boulevard system in Shaker Heights, Ohio, and it was developed with high-speed interstate-like roads with a light rail system in the middle and then local roads on each side. And they built a section of it by 1924. And it was supposed to go from Cleveland to Youngstown, which was a major truck route in those days. And it was considered, it was supposed to be separate levels of transit with no street crossings at all, with this light rail system down the middle.
What have you heard, Andrew?
Well, I don't have. I have a file on this, of course, in the 24 filing cabinets I have. And the debate is, and this actually sounds very familiar. I think I'm thinking more of the Eisenhower, you know, during back in the 50s when they were setting up all the interstates, the major interstates through that system. The debate is that there's one place, and I don't remember the state, where they began the first highway based on what Eisenhower was proposing. There was another state where they had already been building something and it became part of that interstate highway system. So they claim like, well, you know, we were already building it and, you know, so we came earlier, and the other state says, yeah, but you weren't really, it wasn't part of this plan, it was another plan. So I think they're markers at both spots. But as someone who loves to drive, and it's just a great way of seeing this country is to drive all over it, I'm fascinated by just the road system and how it came to be and the thinking behind certain, you know, venues that we have out there and why we take certain routes and the whole planning of it. I mean, it was a massive engineering feat to, you know, we take it for granted because we just drive on these roads. But to put down, I don't know if it's, you know, millions of miles or whatever they did, was an extraordinary thing, cutting through mountains and going over passes and so forth. It was quite a remarkable engineering feat. So it just has some interest to me as a driver.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, can you give Andrew a condensation of the report, the research you did 30 years ago? Is there a way?
Well, I could communicate with him about it. I sure would do that. This was the first time the word superhighway was actually used.
Huh.
What was built in the 40s and 50s, I think the section you're talking about is in Pennsylvania.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It was Pennsylvania.
And but that was a different concept than the original superhighway concept, which grew out of a regional planning association that was looking at how to develop highway systems throughout the United States in the 1920s. And they came up with this concept of the superhighway, and then it was, portions of it were actually built in the 1920s, and they have drawings of this fabulous road system with the multiple layers and the bridges and the light rail running through it. It's like, oh, my God, this vision of the future never happened. Well, it actually did in Chicago and other places. You'll see the freeway with the light rail system down the middle of it.
Yeah. I would love to see it. If you go to the website, hereiswhere, H-E-R-E-I-S-W-H-E-R-E, hereiswhere.org, there's a direct link to my email. And I'll remember you, you know, just put superhighway in the heading, because I would love to follow up with you on this. And one interesting side note, while we're talking about Lincoln, after he was assassinated, some people suggested instead of doing the Lincoln Memorial, create a highway going from, I can't remember where it was, down to Washington, that would be sort of the Lincoln Memorial Highway. And there would be, it would be very artistically done in the median with aspects of Lincoln's life represented and so forth. So you'd really have to reflect on Lincoln himself as you were driving. And of course, it didn't happen. They did the memorial. One quick thing, anyone who goes to the memorial in Washington, which is where I'm from, go down and look at the exhibit underground, which I didn't even know was there. I've been to the memorial a thousand times and never really looked, you know, down below, because what they show is alternate suggestions for the Lincoln Memorial, and it's really fascinating to look at what it might have been as opposed to what they created. So just a little side comment.
Yeah. All right, Bruce, be in touch with Andrew.
Sure.
Thank you. Thanks for your call. 800-486-8655 is our number. We go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Excellent topic. Fine guest.
Thanks.
This isn't what I was going to mention, but if the guest likes to drive, the Taconic Parkway in New York is a proto superhighway.
And as fall coming up, I'm sure it's even especially beautiful now.
What I was wondering, do you have any of the sites of the Black Hawk War, the Black Hawk Trail, such as Battle Island, on your itinerary already?
I don't. Are there any that are unmarked, or are they all pretty well marked at this point?
They refurbished the markers that were put there in the 30s.
Okay. No, I'd love to know that. So it's the Black Hawk Wars.
It's the Black Hawk Trail, and you might pick it up at Battle Island on the Mississippi.
One thing that we want to do with our website is, because even though I'm looking for unmarked places, doesn't mean that we don't want to promote places that are marked but maybe underutilized. And so one thing we're going to put on our website are just that, trails, hikes, Underground Railroad stories and so forth, because when you travel the country, there's something particularly special about doing it when you follow the path of, say, Lewis and Clark or other explorers or these types of trails, and that's a good one that I would not have known about, so I really appreciate that.
And there's a site on the UW campus on the Isthmus next to Bascom Hill where Black Hawk and his people passed, and Abraham Lincoln followed them along. He never quite made it to the war, but he was engaged in it.
Well, and I was just, I can't say what my story is because I got to keep it top secret, but I was just at Bascom Hill about a week or two ago and focusing on a different story, and so I was just up there. It's a beautiful campus. I was there the day they were doing the Ironman race, and they just had a football game, so it was a pretty crowded weekend, but it was a great time to be in Madison.
Yeah, and it's if you know where the John Muir site is, it's the same location, essentially. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And continue your adventures.
I'm in this for life.
That's great. And you're not going to tell us what the story is.
I can't. I got to save it. I got to save a couple out there, just, keep them. But it'll be, next time around, I'll give you all the details.
Okay. How many are you selecting for your book?
Well, I'm going to do, the book will be 50 chapters, so, really 52, because I'm going to do sort of an intro and then end up in Washington, D.C. And it's one story per state, but if anyone who's ever been with a tour guide knows that we really can't stay very linear, that we're always like, okay, I know we're talking about this, but I got to tell you this one little story on the side here, especially if it relates. So I'm going to be doing a lot of that throughout the blogs and just the journey and so forth. But again, this is just the beginning. It's not to do a book. The book will just help us spread the word and focus on certain sites. But I'm not kidding that I really am in this for the long term. And what I most want to do is work with historical societies and get people funding markers. I'm going to do some myself because there are waiting lists. There are a lot of places throughout this country where the local historical society wants to put up a marker, but either for the state funds or the national funds aren't there. And people can contribute. They can say, hey, listen, I want to, I hear you've got this great Lincoln Memorial marker, and not Lincoln Memorial, but some great story. I'd love to underwrite that and help make it possible.
Huh? Yeah. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Paul from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I have three quick hits, if I can touch on them briefly.
Mm-hmm.
One, you talked about Theodore Roosevelt in downtown Milwaukee. There used to be a marker on the Marquette campus about 14th and Wells for Abraham Lincoln, who spoke at that site during the 1860 election campaign, which I think it was a campaign with the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And it was just a marker when I attended Marquette in a parking lot, just to mark the site of that. I have never been able to find it more recently when I've been on the campus. So I think it's kind of just been lost to time or just been turned into a dormitory.
Huh.
The second one I was going to mention is it was the Wisconsin Territory at the time, but Dred Scott, the notorious, infamous Supreme Court decision that said slaves would be property even if they moved into a free state. Dred Scott's story happened at Fort Snelling, which was in the Wisconsin Territory at the time. It's now in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. It's almost underneath the Twin Cities Airport and about a mile or two from the Mall of America. But Dred Scott was at Fort Snelling. He was a slave and the slave of one of the military officers there. And he declared his freedom because he was in a free state when the officer wanted to move back down to Missouri, which was a slave state, a border state, and that's where that developed.
Oh, that's a good story.
Is there a marker there, any mention of him?
Well, Fort Snelling is a national monument, and they do reenactments there and everything, but nowhere do they mention Dred Scott.
Oh.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt you, but really quickly, the story that I did with Fort Snelling, it's on the blog, was during the Civil War, a German military officer came to the United States. So this happened a lot with a lot of these European officers. They wanted to see how the Civil War is being conducted. And he was taken up in a hot air balloon, which the Union Army was using for reconnaissance. Well, his name was von Graf Zeppelin. And he went back to Germany and created, the eponymous Zeppelins. And so
part of World War One.
And it was at Fort Snelling that he did this.
Huh.
So anyway, sorry, I interrupted. You had one more.
It is in Chicago at Clark Street, the Clark Street Bridge in downtown, in the Loop there. There's no marker there now. There may have been in the past, but it's the worst maritime disaster in American inland maritime history, where the Eastland rolled over and sank there, drowning 800, many of them children, in what, like in the teens, 1914, 1916, something like that. No marker there at all at the Clark Street Bridge right now.
How did you come across these, especially that one?
You know, I read the story, and then I happened to be in Chicago for a conference, and I saw Clark Street, so I thought, by gosh, I'm going to find the river, you know, and find the bridge, and no marker, no significant, nothing to note it at all.
And the ship is called the Eastland?
The Eastland is the name of the ship, yeah. It rolled over. It was a Western Electric Company picnic. They chartered three steamers that morning. It was a beautiful day. And everyone wanted to go on the Eastland because it was the sleekest and the fastest. And a speedboat that went by with some celebrity on it, and all the passengers moved to the river side of the ship, which is still moored. And the ship leaned over, and one of the bollards, one of the bits, you know, securing it to the dock, actually broke out, and the ship just slowly rolled over in position. And a lot of the people were already below decks, and they couldn't get out. You know, the portholes weren't large enough to let people make an exit, and they were recovering bodies for days with divers. 800 dead.
Oh,
can you? I'd be really grateful if you would email me, because all three of these are stories I want to pursue, and I want to give you credit for being the one who found them. Would you mind sending me your information?
Not at all.
Okay,
no,
so again, it's hereisware.org, and there's a link to the email. Kathleen, do we have time for a quick story, or are we going into a break?
We have time for a quick story or two.
Okay, great.
Hey, you have that email again, please?
Yeah. Well, the just go to the website. It's hereisware.org, O-R-G, and it'll say to email me, because it'll give you other information, too. But before you go, do you know about the Tribune Building in Chicago?
Oh, tell us that story. I never knew this, and I go there all the time.
Yeah. Do you know this story?
I don't. No.
Okay, so I've been to Chicago many times. I love the city. It's one of my favorites in the U.S. I've passed by the Chicago Tribune Building. It's a beautiful building. And so I'd heard this just literally days before I was going to Chicago. Someone said, you got to check this out at the building. And again, I'd never noticed this before. And so I went and started taking pictures of these things, and people would stop and be like, you know, I've lived in this city my entire life and never noticed this. What's on the side of the building all over are little, you know, maybe fist-size stones, pieces of metal, and so forth from around the world. So, and what happened was the reporters, you know, from the Tribune, as they traveled, this is going back in the 1800s, 1900s, early 1900s, would take a little part of the pyramids, of the Great Wall of China, of there's actually, it goes up to 9/11, there's some metal from the tower. You know, back to, you know, from the U.S. history, there's a chunk from Andersonville Prison, part of the church in Holland that the original, you know, pilgrims left from. So you've got the little clump of material, whether it's stone or steel or glass in some cases, and then a little very brief, you know, mention of what it is. And once you notice them, I mean, you become really enthralled to see of, you know, what else is there. But again, it was just such an incredible experience when I was photographing them. So many people stopped to watch me, and then they were like, wait a minute, I've lived here all these years and never noticed this. And that's really the whole point of this project, is that we walk by these places every single day, and there's some amazing story behind them.
And there are captions on there so you can appreciate the significance of those things?
Absolutely. It'll tell you the date, or maybe not the date, but it'll definitely say, like, you know, Great Wall of China or Jade Gardens or, you know, whatever it might be. And they're literally on all the different sides of the Tribune building.
I've seen that building many times and never, you know, just never really walked up to it. No reason to. So
yep.
It's a great story. Thank you.
Yeah, it is a great story. And yours are as well, Paul. Thank you. I'm from Chicago. I can't believe I never knew that.
And I've talked to some of my friends in Chicago who say, oh, yeah, you know, we grew up knowing that stuff. But again, for some of us, it just slips by. And we can't. There's so many stories out there, it's obviously not possible to know them all. So.
Yeah. So is it something that reporters for the Trib keep in the back of their minds as they're traversing the world, that it's, you know, it's a big story, they need to get a clump of dirt or something and bring it home?
Well, it's a good thing. And I was wondering about that, of just, to be honest, sort of the, you know, the permission aspect of when they took some of these pieces,
right.
How surreptitiously they did it, or if it was with the knowledge of the host country. You know, with 9/11, I'm sure they talked with the city of New York and got that. I haven't seen anything more recent. It may be an issue of, you know, and I'm not sure if there's any more room or what the logistics are of it, but it's just a great history lesson because of, especially with American history, there's one side of the building I think is all American history, and it's just so comprehensive of all the different you know, pieces of stone and metal that they have from these very pivotal points.
Huh. We'll welcome more phone calls for Andrew in a moment. Andrew Carroll is our guest this hour. He's a historian. He is on a 50-state journey, started on July 4th of this year, and he is looking at forgotten history sites in this country, sometimes sites that we just don't know anything about because they're not marked, but people know about them in the area. Sometimes you'll pass one of those historic marker places and you go drive a long way to find out what it is. So he's highlighting some of those as well. But he's got an amazing collection so far and more to come. It will be published in a book. You can also go to his website and he's got tons of places he's already been just in a few months. So if you go to hereisware.org, you can send him suggestions, but you can also look at what he's got, where he's been. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email address here is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Andrew Carroll, our guest, and our next caller is Nate from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Well, good morning, Kathleen. And we got to do a little sport here today. There's no plaque over at 55 Sullivan Place, which is, since we opened this monstrosity down in Dallas over the weekend, the greatest ballpark ever was Ebbets Field with the marble rotunda. And, of course, April 9th, 1947, with Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. And then 2 months later, Pete Reeser crashing into the wall, nearly killing himself in center field. And I just really hope that somebody gets an interest in finding out what Walter F. O'Malley did with the marble.
Did with what, Nate? Oh, my gosh, his phone cut out right at that point in time. Aren't these things marked, Andrew?
No, well, it's amazing what isn't marked. And that's that's the point. And so I'm not familiar with that, but I'm writing down all these notes because I want to look into it. And I'm actually glad he mentioned sports because that is part of our national story. And, some sports events have had national significance, whether they're boxing matches, which, prompted riots, or, Jackie Robinson and what he did for integration. There are a lot of different things that are very important to our history that relate to athletics and so forth. So I'm very glad he mentioned this. And from what I could jot down in that short time, I will definitely look into this.
Yeah. I mean, there could be all these little side things happening as a result of this. You could just have a little book with little known facts about Ebbets Field, right?
Oh, right. And that's with the what we hope to do, and why I say it's really not just about doing a book, is just keep this website growing with different ideas. And what I hope, even if people don't have their own favorite story that's little known, I really hope they'll just spread the word about the project to their history buff friends to say, like, hey, I just heard about this thing, and, you might have a story to contribute, because that's where the best stories come from, is just word of mouth. I mean, I do a lot of research and read through tons of books, and I might see some parenthetical comment about something and say, wait a minute, that's very interesting. One quick example, I was reading in doing my World War II research on Adolf Hitler during World War I and how that's when he earned the Iron Cross. And the lieutenant who gave it to him was actually Jewish. And that lieutenant, during World War II, I mean, he was, of course, 20-some years older at that point, had to flee Germany because of the repercussions, even against veterans who had fought valiantly for Germany during World War I. And Hitler was furious that it was a Jewish man who gave him the Iron Cross. He was very proud of his Iron Cross, but he hated the fact that it was this lieutenant who did it. And that lieutenant moved to me. He was again older at this point. Moved to St. Louis and sold typewriters downtown. And I always think about this. Still a young man at that time, going to work every morning in the 1940s, realizing that he had served with Adolf Hitler, and to see what Hitler was doing to the world at that point, it's just an. And he was a very obscure man; no one knew who he was, but he was at the ground zero of history, and just kind of faded into obscurity after that.
What a story that is, huh? Just think of all those stories that are out there that must keep you going, too, that you don't know about yet.
And that's just, in one city in St. Louis, because I was planning a trip out there, there was a one-legged gymnast who in like 1904, whenever the Olympics were there, 1906, I can't remember exactly, won 3 medals in gymnastics, you know, so despite having one leg. And this was not, there was no, you know, Paralympics at that time, or this was the Olympics. And he too, we just can't find any more information on him, but we're going to keep looking.
Let's go next to, thanks Nate for the call, Ken from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Parenthetically, what do you think of the History Channel and whether or not it's conducive to what you're talking about?
Oh, I love the History Channel. I'm sort of a History Channel fanatic. you know, so anything out there that I think in a very professional way tells these stories, gets them out there, I'm a fan of. So, I'll be honest, there are other books that have focused on little-known history around the U.S. One of my favorites, Jim Lowen, who does the, Lies Across America, markers that are not quite accurate. And if anything, what I want to do is help, not that he needs any help from me, but to bring attention to all these other types of things, because I sort of feel like we're all in this together, that history preservation is so important. There are a lot of history buffs out there, but the more people we have talking about its importance, I think the better. So that might be more of an answer than you were looking for, but I happen to be a fan.
Another Ken from Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hi. A few quick questions, quick comments. One piece of thing that's pretty well known as far as the first paved road, which is in Highland Park, Michigan. And Henry Ford built this because he needed a paved road in order to drive his cars on to make sure that they really ran. And it was right outside his Highland Park plant where he was building the Model Ts. And because of that, our roads are paved.
Now, is that marked?
I don't think it is. You know, it's a real well-known piece of road in the Detroit area. Everyone knows where it is. It's 1 mile. And I don't think it's marked.
My only car-related story so far is that Bob Marley worked in the Chrysler plant in Delaware for about, it was a couple months back in 1967 or 66 before he moved back to Jamaica and then became the international sensation that he became. And so that was, it's not marked, not surprisingly, but he was there, and he also worked, I think, in a DuPont lab, but he was mostly at the Chrysler plant in Delaware.
And the interesting thing is that this original plant that Ford had before he started his River Rouge complex is shut. They closed it down, and it's just wasting away.
That happened to the Chrysler plant, too. They just closed that as well.
Yeah.
But that's a great one. I'm definitely going to mark that down.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call. Tell us the discovery of Langston Hughes.
Oh, that's one of my favorites. And that's close to me. That's literally up the street from where I live, which is, again, to show that, you know, in our hometowns, there are just so many things around us that we might not even be aware of. So this is back, I think it was 1927. I might have that year wrong because I don't have it in front of me. But a very prominent poet named Vachel Lindsay was dining at the, I think it was called the Wardman Park back then, and now it's the Wardman Park Marriott. And he was very, very famous in America as a poet. And this young busboy who was working to be a poet kind of came up to him as Lindsay was having dinner and put 3 of his own poems on the table. And at first, I think Lindsay was a little dismissive, like, please don't interrupt me. But then he read the poems, and he's like, this young man is actually quite brilliant. So that night at the public lecture he was giving at the Wardman Park, he said, I just want to add that I've recently read the poems of this brilliant young busboy poet. That was Langston Hughes. And the next day, newspapers across the country began writing stories about Hughes, and it's really what I think, you know, helped him become so well known. But Hughes was on his way. It's not that he was completely unknown at the time. He had won some awards for his poetry. He was publishing and so forth, but that definitely helped. I mean, he himself admitted that if it weren't for that incident, you know, he's not sure if he would have been as famous as he became.
Mm. Isn't it something how things just happen partially because of timing, all the timing of things?
It's almost, I think, all of them. when you look at, especially I've been doing a lot on innovations and medical discoveries, so many of them were by accident. Whether it was the discovery of penicillin or, up to Viagra. I was reading a story how they're using Viagra now to fight the war on terror because the warlords in Afghanistan really like it, and they're giving information to U.S. troops just, trading for Viagra. And so I was reading the history of that and how that, I think, was discovered by mistake as well. So it's interesting about all these different, so many of these innovations were done, serendipitously.
Right. We have about a minute left. Kay from Black River Falls. Hi.
I was wondering if you knew anything about the Wazee Trail. You have heard of it?
No, I don't. No, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay, the story I had heard is when they took the Indians from the Black River Falls area and sent them to, I believe, Nebraska, and they walked back. And I believe the Wazee Trail is the trail that they took back to Black River Falls, and they now have a mission up here. But I'm not sure if that's the right story or not.
Do you know? So you're not sure if the trail is marked or not?
No, the trail is marked.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'll add that because, again, as I said before, I want to add to our website trails that people can take across the country. And, you know, there are a lot of great stories out there associated with these, and it's a great way of seeing the country when you really have a purpose to it. So you're not just driving from one spot to the next, but you're learning about these places as you go. It's almost like a pilgrimage, and that's what's important about these visiting these sites is that you're reflecting on them along the way. So it makes the visit more meaningful than just if you stop off somewhere. Although I love those unexpected places as well.
Yeah. Thank you, Kay, so much for the call. So the website to go to is hereiswhere.org.
Correct. And it's H-E-R-E-I-S. A lot of people think it's here's with an apostrophe, but that's not. It's H-E-R-E-I-S-W-H-E-R-E.org. Hereiswhere.org. All sorts of information on what we're looking for. People have very graciously offered to send us donations. We don't accept those. We would rather have them give them to the local historical society. It's not about that for us. It's really just raising awareness of what's out there, the importance of preserving our history, and that the historians in our communities, at the libraries and the historical sites are the real heroes of America.
Right. Andrew, thank you so much. We're plumb out of time. Carry on, sir. Andrew Carroll, our guest. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production. News is coming up. We'll be with you again tomorrow here on the Ideas Network.